Home? I have no home. The jungle is my home. Hunted, despised, living like an animal. But I shall create a race of atomic supermen. Pull the string!
No, I've got no idea. You've just got a much better, you've got a higher level of cultural capital than I do, David, I'm afraid.
That is from one of my favourite movies of all time, Ed Wood, starring Johnny Depp, directed by, what's his name, Edward Scissorhands guy, what's he called?
Tim Burton. Oh yeah, they're sort of lifelong marriage there, Tim Burton and Johnny Depp.
Yeah.
Well, now that we know what that was, I can say that we are the Religious Studies Project. He is...
David Robertson, and he is...
Christopher Carter. And we are here in a slightly different location this week. We're still in Edinburgh, we're in the Café Marlene at the top of... is this the top of Leith Walk?
This is the top of Leith Walk, yeah. We've ventured northward. Greetings if you've come to us from Reddit and are hearing this podcast for the first time. You're very welcome. What is this podcast, Chris?
This podcast is the third in our Origins or Reductionism series. It is an interview recorded by Jack Sonis, so we're giving Tommy Coleman a week off. Although, great job, Tommy, for the last couple of interviews. It's Merlin Donald talking on ritual, religion, and culture. And this was recorded at the AAR back in November. So I think we can just pass over to Jack now, basically. Take it away.
Today it is my great honour and pleasure to be sitting with Professor Merlin Donald, a neuroscientist and psychologist who is one of the world's leading scholars on the cognitive evolution of the human mind. Professor Donald is an emeritus professor in the Department of Psychology in the Faculty of Education at Queen's University in Ontario, Canada. And aside from his vast list of scientific papers, Professor Donald is also the author of two influential books, The Origins of the Modern Mind, Three Stages in the Evolution of Culture and Cognition, which was published by Harvard in 1991, and also A Mind So Rare, The Evolution of Human Consciousness, published by Norton in 2001. Now, one of the central ideas underpinning these books is that there is a unique feature of human cognition that separates us from all other species in the biosphere, and this is what Professor Donald calls the brain-culture symbiosis, which points to the fact that our brains have evolved to operate in complex, distributed cognitive networks. Now, we'll come to this basic perspective in a moment. However, Professor Donald and I are currently sitting in Baltimore at the American Academy of Religion meeting, as you may be able to hear from the dinging elevators and ruffling around of people. And he's just delivered a paper entitled Religion, Ritual, and the Drama of Daily Life, The Continued Dominance of Mimetic Representation. Now, the title of that talk might not be immediately clear to all listeners, but by the end of this half hour, we'll hopefully explicate exactly what that means. And it was indeed a fascinating session. Now, a final point of introduction is that Professor Donald has been grafted into religious studies only quite recently and is attending the AAR meeting as a specialist from another field. And primarily, and please correct me if I'm wrong here, but primarily... Professor Donald has been brought into religious studies because of Robert Beller's new work, Religion in Human Evolution, from the Paleolithic to the Axial Age. And that's another issue we will talk about today. But before coming to the specifics, we need to lay out the basics. So, without further ado, Merlin Donald, thank you for talking to the Religious Studies Project.
You're welcome.
Yeah, so before we get into the specifics of the talk that you just delivered, and the way in which your work has been used in religious studies, I'm wondering if you could explain to us, on the one hand, the basic research questions that have sort of motivated your work and your sort of two books, and then secondly, on top of this, your findings and your basic perspective on the evolution of our brains and of our mind.
Well, it was no accident that I chose the title of my first book, The Evolution of the Modern Mind, because I think the modern mind is quite different from our ancestral mind at various stages of human evolution, and the structuring of the mind in particular is something that's central to my concern as a psychologist. And I've made the argument that our mind is structured both by the innate brain mechanisms that I've studied. I am a neuroscientist by training.
And innate meaning the kind of just basic...
The things that are given in genetics and in the basic neural architecture of the brain, the basic neuroanatomy of the brain, if you want, which is, in our case, we have a gigantic primate brain, but it's still very much a primate brain. It's not fundamentally different in its architecture as far as we can see. And yet the functional architecture, that it's the software, can so radically organize the way the hardware is used that in effect the brain becomes capable of different things. It gains powers through its interaction with culture. And that was an insight that took a long time to germinate in me, because I'd come up at a time in cognitive science when these ideas were simply not on the table.
Why weren't they on the table?
The idea was that the brain ultimately generates culture. That you get the brain to evolve to a certain stage, and then it somehow comes up with language, and then it somehow comes up with culture.
Right, so it put the sort of the horse before the cart.
I put it the other way around.
Language
took a very long time to emerge, and that there were a number of earlier adaptations that had to happen before language became even a possibility.
This is by far the most fascinating point for me, this idea that language is only 100 to 200, somewhere 1,000 years old, yet the clear tendencies of modern humans begin almost 2 million years ago. If you want to maybe explain...
I think the thing that happened about 2 million years ago is that we became skilled, and we became skilled about 1.5 million years before we started to become articulate. And that's an idea that it's not immediately obvious if you look at human beings. Language is so dominant that really the whole story of human evolution has almost been reduced to a search for the language evolution.
Yeah, that's why I found it so interesting.
But the hard evidence that we have is that we were skilled long before we had complex kinds of cultures that we attribute to language.
And the hard evidence being?
The hard evidence is tools made out of the hardest substance known at the time, which was flint and then obsidian, which are both well over 1 million years in use with human ancestors. The thing about those tools, and I call that the master toolkit, is that they're made from the hardest and sharpest substances around, and therefore they can be used to manufacture other tools. So you have tools that can you use to manufacture other tools. For example, once you have a cutting instrument made out of lint or obsidian, you can carve wood and make spears, or you can cut hide and make tethers, or make, in some cases, clothing or shelter. You can also butcher animals. They're very large and very strong. And eventually prepare food. And it implies a certain type of intelligence, and I've studied that to some extent. It's my core hypothesis that you cannot master or even invent those kinds of skills without what I call mimetic imagination. And imagination that you need to master skills on this level is best illustrated in modern humans, in things like the arts, in athletics, and in craft. And I think those kinds of skills have gotten us through some very tough times as a species for about 2 million years. So we're skilled craftsmen and artists long before we were articulate creatures. And that says a lot about the durability of this aspect of human culture. For example, trades and crafts are still taught by apprenticeship. I'll give you an image to give you an idea of something that the importance of this. When a city like Berlin was virtually bombed into the ground in the Second World War, it somehow miraculously reappeared within a decade or two, which is quite amazing. How did that happen? There were hundreds of thousands of people killed, and the city was essentially obliterated physically. Other areas of the earth, which were similarly obliterated, did not regenerate. The reason was that in the population, the knowledge, the skills existed, and they persisted despite all of the damage that was done. So
that's a physical skill.
If you want,
the workhorse adaptation of human culture is skill, distributed skill. And this also, from a computational point of view, is interesting because this is the first instance of what we call distributed cognitive networks. That is to say, networks that engage many brains in a coordinated way to create an environment, what I call a cognitive ecosystem in which people operate. So this is a breakthrough of monumental proportions. Yeah. It came from a relatively quite feasible and fairly simple change in brain structure, which was primarily a matter of connecting the action systems to the event perceptual systems in the brain. This may not be on topic, but that's...
No, that's all...
From an evolutionary point of view, very feasible adaptation.
No, that's definitely on topic, although something else I wanted to ask you is, you know, at the moment you're talking about the physical skills of humans, but you also make the argument that this kind of revolution in physical skill also had a revolution in... our representational tendencies and capacities. Yeah. So, and that'll be a good point to...
Yeah, because once you have that core development, that capacity, that mimetic imagination in place, what you have is the potential for a mind-sharing culture, that is, for a culture in which there is a degree of coordination between human beings in terms of what they know and in terms of customs and conventions. And in fact, the argument that's really compelling is that you could never evolve language until you had a mimetic adaptation in place, simply because you can't create the basis for words, that is, a morphophonology of language, without a capacity for refined skill. It's simply inconceivable. Mm. So
And you say as well that language was there to disambiguate the kind of rich of meaning that
that's right.
developed in mimetic culture.
I think what happened was that there's some evidence of a degree of expansion of the brain after the initial... There was a great leap that led up between 2 million and 1.8 million years ago in brain capacity in hominids. But then that capacity gradually increased until somewhere around 500,000 to about 200,000 years ago. There was a real ramping up, what Chris Wills in San Diego called the runaway brain. There's an extraordinary increase in brain capacity up to modern capacity. And in fact, the only way to explain that is in terms of the increasingly complex cultures that started to appear about 400,000 years ago, where the toolkit suddenly starts to enlarge. Obviously, the range of human activity as groups, group activity, seems to get more complex until you have burials, you have signs of coordinated campsites that are built structures, things like longhouses and so on start to appear. And so you have a stage in human culture where one thinks that the evolutionary contingencies were driving people towards a need for more and more coordination on a social level. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where language comes in, because language is, to me, not language until you get narratives. Mm-hmm. That is to say, unless when the children acquire language, the first thing they acquire is a sort of mimetic use of language. They master words and they use them in context in ways that are appropriate. So it's only about age 4 that they actually can tell their own stories.
And begin to actually use language rather than say words.
Well, they become independent agents in terms of constructing narratives. And to me, that's the telling level. It's not so much being able to formulate words. It's quite possible that much earlier on in mimetic culture, there were the equivalent of words.
Well, yeah, you used the phrase the prosodic control of the voice.
Yes.
I believe that's your phrase,
yes,
is it not?
Yes.
Could you explain what that? Because there's the tendency to say, well, before language then, it was either just grunting or nothing or something.
No, prosodic modulation is a natural aspect of mimesis. Mimesis is situated at the top of the cognitive pyramid. So anything that was in the voluntary motor repertoire of primates was subject to this adaptation. And that means that the voluntary vocalizations could be modulated and modified and deliberately produced to produce effects in an audience, for example. Mm-hmm. You can get very far on just prosody. Prosody is about emphasis. It's about directing attention. It can be combined with gesture, and
it can be expressive.
Yeah. Very extremely expressive, sort of expressing emotions, collective emotions. So, for example, you could have rituals that involved expressions of grief that were collective, mm-hmm. or celebration that were collective, or challenges in what we think of as war dances and so on. They don't have to involve words or narratives. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They can be group displays. I expect that all of that was present in mimetic culture at one point or another long before language.
We'll come back to that because that relates fundamentally to the point of your talk. Mm-hmm. But just quickly, if you could maybe for our audience as well, just explain then what comes after the mimetic stage. I mean, you sort of mentioned language, but then if you could take us from sort of language to writing, and then revolution.
From my point of view, the next big stage after the arrival of narrative culture and what I call mythic culture, because once you can tell stories, you can create a mythic environment in which sort of becomes the governing level.
Comprehensive thought.
Well, typically in classic human cultures, you have a theocratic rule. You have a government that is based on beliefs which are based on very strong myths, which are often attributed to divine intervention.
Transcendental source,
But then below that, you have all of the mimetic customs and rituals and so on, which are so important in entrenching the culture, which often outlive the myths. That is to say, they're very durable, I think, because they're the most ancient part of culture. So that was the standard form of culture until fairly recently. I think with writing, writing was used in a mythic context to strengthen the social order that had already been developed in that context.
Yeah, the first time the linguistic narratives got written down.
Well, they were always either legal or historical codices or justifications of royal prerogative and so on. But later on, writing led to analytic thought. The first examples, I think, being in Greece, Periclean, Athens, and so on, where you have suddenly the possibility of a debate being extended over generations, over centuries. Mm-hmm. So a mathematician could reply to Pythagoras 500 years later. A philosopher could reply to Aristotle 1,000 years later, or whatever. A remarkable fact is that we went through a thing called the exographic revolution. Exograms are basically the external equivalent of engrams. Engrams is Carl Ashley's idea for a memory in the brain. Well, an exogram is a memory written
an externalized memory.
In a non-biological system. Once you get exograms, you change the whole structure of the cognitive field, and it also changes the way the brain allocates its resources, because you're part of a distributed system, and therefore you have a major reorganization of the whole architecture.
So devoting more resources then towards other activities.
We have good example from children studies of children that very young children long before school are able to understand that if they can write something down or draw something, they no longer have to remember it. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be pointed out to them. Your memory storage is very selective, and simply, there used to be the myth that if you repeated something or you're exposed to something, you'd automatically remember everything that you repeated. That's not true.
Obviously not.
You can decide not to remember things, mm-hmm. On a remarkable scale. So external memory does that. It lightens the load, and it also redistributes the load because the knowledge is out there. So it frees up a lot of space.
Yeah, I believe John Locke said that there are two kinds of knowledge, things that you know and things that you know where to look up.
That's right, exactly. and the other thing is that undoubtedly there is a memory revolution that occurs in two stages. Spoken language itself is a revolution. Mm-hmm. We know that because the studies of adults who learn sign, deaf adults who can't sign and learn sign, let's say, at age 30, suddenly have an autobiographical memory. They didn't have that before. They were relying on sporadic little snippets of episodic memory, little glimpses of experiences, but they didn't have any organized, mm-hmm. selfish
because they
kind
didn't.
Of
have a
core.
Have a system to organize it.
That's right.
So memories
and they
sort
can't
of
access
free,
it. And they're all of their verses, yeah. once they master sign, they're astounded by the change, and they can barely remember their earlier life. And this is a universal, I explored that in my second book at some length, because we went to the Perkins Institute and studied the story of Helen Keller, who's maybe the first really well-documented case of this kind. So it's a very interesting aspect that language itself revolutionizes autobiographical memory and your ability to retrieve the past, and that writing takes that a lot further because, in fact, you can then offload all kinds of stuff to the outside world. So in oral culture, you relied on other people's memories to remember all of the things that had, so a bard would know all of the stories. A witch doctor would know all of the pharmacopoeia or all of the procedures for curing illness and so on. There were specialists, but they were human brains that were the source of these offloadings. So all of a sudden, when you have encyclopedias and archives and the internet, you offload a massive amount, and therefore the possibility of acquiring almost an infinite amount of knowledge is there.
I suppose, which
is,
as well, the engineering revolutions of the last sort of beginning 6,000 years ago obviously completely related to that lexicographic external.
You can't do it otherwise, or you have to have. Now, it doesn't always mean writing. So, for example, it's estimated that the way the Egyptians leveled the pyramids, which are so vast, you wonder how could they be so true, perfectly straight up. Well, in fact, they used an lexicographic system that involved channeling in the bedrock and filling it with water. Mm-hmm. And they knew that if the water spread through the entire pattern, the labyrinth, they would have a level. So it was like a gigantic level. Mm. That's an instrument, it's a scientific instrument on a massive scale.
Yeah.
Stonehenge is also a scientific instrument on a massive scale. It allows you to calculate solstices and eclipses and so on. So writing does not necessarily have to be micro in its scale.
No,
it could be macro,
not.
You see.
Yeah.
And hexagrams, in other words, can be very large or very small, depending on where you are in your cultural evolution. But they do change what we do with our minds, and they restructure memory in particular in dramatic ways that have huge computational implications.
But of course, one of the other central notions is that we are hybrid minds. That is, we are sort of, these different, the episodic, the mimetic, the mythic, and now the theoretic are kind of layered.
They're all layered, yes. You never leave anything behind in these accumulations.
They always get reorganized, but
it's because each of these adaptations serves a different purpose. And that's why you can't really get rid of the mimetic level, and you can't really get rid of the mythic level, because the mythic, you don't have autobiographical memory, you don't have an identity, you don't even have a cultural identity. So it's an absolutely crucial stage. And that's a mistake that I think some recent thinkers have made in thinking that we can move to what I call theoretic culture and jettison all the rest.
Yeah.
You can't. The hierarchy is such that the oldest, most durable part of our culture is mimetic. The second oldest and most durable is the mythic, the narrative level. And the most recent and, in a sense, tenuous and delicate is the theoretic.
Because if all the knowledge got blown up.
Analytic thought and paradigmatic thought is mostly a product of the last 200 or 300 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be institutionalized. And is very dependent on technology, and we have built this apparatus. The question is, will it endure? Are we able to manage the world that we've created? And that's my concern right now, is that theoretic culture could blow up in our face if we're not careful.
Yeah. Although then this is a perfect sort of point, the idea of the hybrid mind, to bring us back to the topic of your talk today.
Mm-hmm.
And just to remind the audience, the talk was called... Religion, Ritual, and the Drama of Daily Life, the Continued Dominance of Mimetic Representation. So could you explain to us what you spoke about down there?
Yes, mimetic representation is really embodied performance art. You can think of us all as performance artists, and we're embedded in a cultural world where we have to perform various roles at different times of the day and in different contexts, and we bounce off one another. We are very inspired and challenged by one another. We're also sometimes excluded or defeated by one another, and so we're exquisitely attuned to our social connection. That's very deep. That's very mimetic. It's also to some degree very coercive.
Sorry, could you say that again? It's to some degree very coercive.
It can be very coercive because there's a tremendous tendency towards conformity to all of these different norms. That is basically a mimetic tendency. People assume parallel postures. They adjust their accents and their tone of voice to one another. They're exquisitely attuned to the reception of the person listening to them, or the effect they're having on the person they're addressing. And that goes back to, I would say, pre-linguistic times when we were constructing these nonverbal ritualist or ritualized networks of practice that were related initially to tool-making, then to ritual, then to more complicated kinds of things, such as maintaining a home base and a social hierarchy of status and so on in a small community.
Can you explain to us as well? It seems to be important to... You've got a quite specific usage of the word ritual. In common parlance, we'd think of ritual as something, you know, like sacrificing a goat chanting or something. Now, obviously, it's a lot more complicated there, but if you could just, you know...
Well, I think Darwin talked about the ritualization of emotional expression in animals. What he meant was that certain sequences, quite complicated sequences of expression, become stereotyped and
therefore formalized sequence.
Formalized, and they involve several players, so they would, the animals react to one another. So if you want to submit to a superior, the gesture is meaningless unless you have a dominant other present at the same time.
Yeah.
So ritual is socially embedded. In the case of humans, it's far more complicated because we are in inventing or creating these patterns. So conventions, as opposed to stereotypy, are not species universal. They're particular to particular groups of people who invent different conventions. And those conventions are mostly ritualized. And I would argue that there's simply no way to explain what human beings were able to do, let's say 500,000 years ago, without invoking some kind of ritualization as a key.
Now, let me... Two phrases stood out from the talk for me, so maybe you can just keep elaborating if we go off those.
Mm-hmm.
First is that ritual is... you construe ritual as a cognitive system.
It's a governance system.
A governance system. And then the other point... that I suppose links with that, is that religious ritual reflects basic systemic requirements of distributed cognition.
Yes.
So the distributed cognition and systems of governance, if you could again just kind of
distributed
emphasize.
Cognition is cognition that involves many minds or many brains working in concert. To achieve distributed cognition, you need some kind of a governance structure, okay? And ritual is perfect. So just think of the Nuremberg rallies, or think of a football game, or
the education system.
Yes, or a religious ritual. It doesn't really matter. The ceremony, the structure, is dictated by convention.
Mm-hmm.
There are things you can do and can't do. It often involves very coercive rules as to how you can behave, how you can dress. And in fact, that can... You could be executed in Rome for example, dressing as an aristocrat. If in fact you weren't, if you wore patrician purple, you were in deep trouble unless you were a patrician.
Yeah.
So the ritual, it comes down to the fine level. I mean, you can walk down, Wall Street in various outfits, but you can't walk down Wall Street naked and or in your pajamas without, shall we say, attracting a lot of attention.
Mm-hmm.
There are strict conventions. They're very coercive. So in a sense, they're governance structures because they force behavior to take a certain pattern. They also force the mind of the individual to align itself with the conventions of the particular culture. So it's an alignment method, and therefore you can think of it as a governance structure. Human culture without governance structures would be essentially anarchic, would lack structure.
Because, one thing we all know is that we're an intensely social sort of species.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose this idea of governance structures is really important to understand how it is that such a diverse, and complicated animal can coordinate.
Yes, and we have to understand that this applies regardless of whether you have a formal government or not, or whether you have a formal labeled leader. That is, governance structures will emerge spontaneously out of groups simply trying to operate and function,
mm-hmm.
Because they must do this to coordinate their activity.
Now, if I could also get you to... You said in the abstract of your talk that that shared cognitive systems are coordinated by public rituals and that these public rituals are epitomised by religion. So what is it? What do you think of when you think, you know, I'm thinking about religious rituals and I'm thinking about these as the epitome yeah. of... Like, what in your mind, are the great examples or the really, you know, interesting
well,
ones?
I mean, the coronation of a king used to be something that was... to be made official, religiously sanctioned, right? Mm-hmm. Because the king's powers were derived from divine sources, mm-hmm. presumably, and so it was very important that the king get the approval of the religious authority, whatever it was. I think if you go back far enough, rulers and high priests were almost the same person, certainly the same governance structure. Mm-hmm. So there was no distinction between religion and secular government. Mm-hmm. There was no...
It certainly emerges after the Reformation, really.
I'd say it's really post-Enlightenment that you see this distinction. And in a way, religion is simply a label for the old regime, mm-hmm. because the new regimes were... very similar in terms of leaning on ritual and on myths.
Their
and
sort
so
of
on.
Governance strategies.
Absolutely. So when nationalism replaced religion in Europe at one point as the main governance strategy, what did they all get? They all get a song, a flag. They got a kind of a kit before yeah. you could become a nation. You
had to have a set of myths.
A composer. You had to have a national literature. And if you didn't have these things, somehow the nation, in quotes, didn't cohere. That's, of course, a 19th century strategy. I'm not sure it's appropriate anymore, although it's very hard to kill, because there is a need for that kind of coordination. And religion is still very much a force in the world, probably still, in many ways, as great a force as nationalism. So these are different ways of aligning people. Theoretic culture is... influence is mostly through corporations, science, and technology, and it's kind of an overlay now that is trying to, it's kind of subversive of those previous ways of doing business. Mm-hmm. Whether they can actually survive with that strategy in the absence of things like nations and religions is highly problematic. Mm-hmm. I rather doubt that they can,
yeah.
for a variety of reasons. And that's one of my concerns right now, one of the things I'm working on.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Now, we've got to wrap things up, but I did want to ask you, just for our last couple of minutes, let's come back to the way in which you've kind of been brought into religious mm-hmm. studies, which is primarily through the work of Robert Beller, and his quite sort of astounding mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. recent mm-hmm. book, Religion and Human Evolution, 2011, Harvard University Press. What do you make of the way... I mean, I'm not going to, for our audience, go through Beller's entire thesis, but basically he follows your stages of cognitive evolution, and he's interested in he uses a Geertzian definition of religion, so it's an interlocking set of symbols embedded in culture, therefore, to track the evolution of religion, you need to track the evolution of symbolic thought, and that's why he finds your... perspective so interesting. But the thing that's distinctive about Beller's approach is that he still uses this narrative of the axial age. So the emergence of theoretic culture... for him, kind of, it equates with the emergence of these new forms of religion, that were emerged in complex urban societies with social stratification. But that sort of differs as well from your idea that theoretic culture is sort of latent in that period, but really only becomes manifest in the 16th, 17th century in Europe. So, I don't know, I'm interested to hear your perspective on given how important you are for Beller's work, what do you think of it?
Well, Bob and I have had that discussion on more than one occasion, and in fact I replied to his work in a subsequent volume edited by Bella and Joas just the last year, and also in a number of other locations, including some websites. It's a question of interpretation. He has chosen to single out reflection, that is, a reflective society that is actually reflecting on the significance of its texts as a sign of theoretic culture. Well, it's one of a number of early signs that human beings were starting to construct something like an open-minded, evidence-based theoretical universe. But my argument would be that that was a very preliminary stage, and that until all of that was institutionalized on a massive scale, mm-hmm. You couldn't argue for the existence of anything that I would call a culture. I think that briefly in Periclean Athens, there may have been something like that for about 100 years, and then it was gone. I don't think it existed really in Rome, except on the and certain domains, and you can say, well, it feels like engineering or in certain academic fields, there was the beginning of institutionalized structures, but they dissolved, and they you know, there were so many wars and invasions and so many civilizations that rose and fell during that time. There wasn't enough stability to really establish. It wasn't until the Enlightenment and then the Industrial Revolution that began to create such a solid and enduring instantiation of the idea of symbolic control over both the physical world and the human world. That is the sign of one of the great inventions was bureaucracies. Mm. Well, bureaucracies themselves were, in a sense, the first close thing to theoretic culture, in my view, because you had record keeping, you had enforcement of taxes, you had feedback loops from that were driven mostly by financial considerations and resource considerations. That was probably the nucleus, but it's not enough, because the overriding belief system in those days was entirely religious and entirely mythic, in my view. Mm-hmm. And until you had almost a takeover, and that's what happened in the 19th century, of mythic culture by a burgeoning theoretic mm-hmm. tendency, that started to change. We've had a galloping series of changes in the last 100 years that have led to a very dominant economic system on a global level that is entirely theoretic and linked to science and engineering. However, it is often in complete opposition to the traces or remnants of mythic culture mm-hmm. worldwide. So it's I wouldn't say it's a culture war, but it's a very major source of stress. I think we've misidentified the problem by saying, well, it's Islamic versus secular. That's silly. In fact, the stresses and strains exist in every single country on Earth right now. Mm-hmm.
And every single governance system, regardless absolutely. Of whether yeah. it's
the real fault line is between theoretic and mythic.
Yeah.
And the mimetic, of course, goes along with the mythic. It's embedded mm-hmm. and it's very stable. It's always there.
All right. Well, I would love to keep chatting, but unfortunately, that's all we've got time for today. So thank you very much for your time. Greatly
You're very
appreciate
welcome.
It. And thanks for your inspiring scholarship.
It's the first time I've ever been interviewed in a corridor of elevators.
Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot, Mel.
Yep.
Thanks, Jack, for another fascinating interview. This whole series has been quite interesting, I think, and has been receiving a fair bit of coverage, leverage. What's the word?
Yeah, it's been getting a lot of hits. I think it's because there's a certain element of the titles of the interviews, and the whole series kind of ties in with maybe more populist discourse on, religion, the origins of religion, evolutionary theory, sort of psychology, cognitive science, mm-hmm. that sort of stuff. So we've been getting maybe a bit more of the outside the academic community, perhaps, which is a good thing. So hopefully you'll stick around for some future podcasts as well.
It's a great point, and it is a good thing. It's one of the reasons we started the project, and hopefully these kind of these interviews will introduce people to a slightly more nuanced version of conversations that they might already be having about it was interesting that this popped up on Reddit on the atheism page, for instance.
And even just because the title of last week's interview was why religion's natural and science is not, and you could just see people bouncing off that title and misinterpreting what the interview might have been about, and then other people correcting them, and it was That's exactly the sort of thing that we want every podcast to do, you know, to provoke reactions for people to look into things in more depth than they might have done already. So I'm going to leave next week's one to you, David. It's another one with Tommy Coleman.
Yeah, it's with Ara Norenzayan, and it's entitled Big Gods, the Role of Religion in the Formation of Society. I suspect we might have to shorten that by the time we actually put it out.
Absolutely, and that's based on Ara's most recent book.
So interesting, I mean, this week's one we've just heard was religion and the development of culture, whereas next week we've got religion and the development of society. It'd be interesting to see how those two... whether they're using two different words for the same thing or whether they have rather different takes.
On the topic of developing society, we've been developing our society here at the Religious Studies Project.
Like what you did there, Chris, that was classy.
I'm going to announce right now the winner, the lucky winner of the title of our Opportunities Digest editor. I'm going to say Jana Shuli, but David might have a different pronunciation and that might not be right at all.
Well, the online translator that I looked at had Skold Nye, but it doesn't sound right to me.
No.
So we're going to go Skold Nye.
Yeah, we might just call you Jane as well.
We'll just say Jane whenever possible. Yeah.
But it's brilliant to have you on board. She's based at the University of Bergen, and hopefully in another podcast or two, we'll maybe get an introduction in audio form, and she'll be on the team page on the website very soon.
And she's going to be taking charge of the Opportunities Digest initially. That's going to be her sort of day-to-day role, yes.
So if you want to send her material for that, you can send it to opsdigest@religiousstudiesproject.com.
That's OPPS digest, all one word, at religiousstudiesproject.com. Do also send us your thoughts and comments to editors at Religious Studies Project. You can comment, critique, criticise, and make suggestions on our Facebook page.
Our Twitter feed or Google+. And in the iTunes comment section where you can also like us. And I'm just going to put a final mention for Amazon. I think you maybe get lulled, listeners, into a false sense of security with Amazon, because over the Christmas period, so many of you really embraced that call and utilized it. But now that Christmas is over, please do keep using the Amazon links. We've got the Canadian, American, and UK-based Amazon sites so far. Just, if you go onto our website, click through from there. Doesn't cost you any more money, but we earn quite a significant amount in referral fees. So just a wee consciousness-raising mention there of our Amazon links.
Indeed, remember that this is entirely free for your use, and if you use the Amazon link, you can give a little bit back to the project, ensure its survival into the future without any outlay of your own. But I think that's all we need to say, isn't it?
Done enough here.
There is one thing that we do need to say.
Is it... thanks for listening.